At that time, Freud's young nephew, Edward Bernays, was working as a press agent in America. His main client was the world-famous opera singer Caruso, who was touring the United States. Bernays's parents had emigrated to America 20 years before, but he kept in touch with his uncle and joined him for holidays in the Alps. But Bernays was now about to return to Europe for a very different reason. On the night that Caruso opened in Toledo, Ohio, America announced it was entering the war against Germany and Austria. As a part of the war effort, the US government set up a committee on public information, and Bernays was employed to promote America's war aims in the press. The president, Woodrow Wilson, had announced that the United States would fight not to restore the old empires, but to bring democracy to all of Europe. And Bernays proved extremely skillful in promoting this idea, both at home and abroad. And at the end of the war, he was asked to accompany the president to the Paris Peace Conference.
Then, to my surprise, they asked me to go over with Woodrow Wilson to the Peace Conference. And at the age of maybe 26, I was in Paris for the entire time of the Peace Conference that was held in the suburb of Paris, and we worked to make the world safe for democracy. That was a big slogan.
Wilson's reception in Paris astounded Bernays and the other American propagandists. Their propaganda had portrayed Wilson as a liberator of the people, a man who would create a new world in which the individual would be free. They had made him a hero of the masses. And as he watched the crowd surge around Wilson, Bernays began to wonder whether it would be possible to do the same type of mass persuasion, but in peacetime.
When I came back to the United States, I decided that if you could use propaganda for war, you could certainly use it for peace. And propaganda got to be a bad word because of the Germans using it. So what I did was to try to find some other words. So we found the word Council on Public Relations.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to the National News Services, AP and UPI?
Well, again, I think we're getting into the kind of detail, Mr. Chairman, that I'd prefer to handle in executive session.
We are in an information war, and we are losing that war. I'll be very blunt in my assessment. Al Jazeera is winning. The Chinese have opened up a global English language and multi-language television network. The Russians have opened up an English language network. I've seen it in a few countries, and it's quite instructive. We are cutting back. The BBC is cutting back. So here's what we are trying to do. You know, in the State Department, we have pushed very hard on new media. So we have an Arabic Twitter feed. We have a Farsi Twitter feed. I have this group of young, techno experts who are out there engaging on websites, and we're putting all of our young Arabic-speaking diplomats out so that they are talking about our values. Walter is working hard with his board to try to, you know, transform the broadcasting efforts, because most people still get their news from TV and radio. So even though we're pushing online, we can't forget TV and radio. And so I would look very much toward cooperation to try to figure out how we get back in the game on this, because I hate ceding what we are most expert in to anybody else.
Everybody's restless and they got no place to go. Someone's always trying to tell them something they already know. So their anger and resentment flow. But
oh, hey there, folks. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is March 19th, 2012, and this is the introduction to the series on logical fallacies. So just before we get into this, I just want to expand a little bit on what we're doing here. Now, logical fallacies are part of a much larger discipline of critical thinking, something that we've talked about on this show, and I've tried to apply to the topics we've discussed on this show since the beginning. I've tried. I've done my best, and hopefully my best will get better in the future. But logical fallacies are essentially a subset of logic and rhetoric. And logic and rhetoric are two subsets of critical thinking, or a classical education, or the trivium, a word you're going to hear today on the show, which all pretty much driving at the same thing, different ways of saying it, different ways to, but I'm going to let my guests explain all that. Now, why am I doing this series? Well, first of all, logic is usually not the starting point in the mastery of a subject. But we live in a world where, because of time constraints and other factors, we can't just pick each and every subject we wish to be experts on and then pursue it to mastery. You know, and a lot of things that we want to look at are brought to our attention by someone else, either by the empty echo chamber of the agenda shaping and opinion manipulating mainstream media, or by the alternative media that we choose for ourselves. But that's how we're introduced to a lot of issues. That's, for example, that's how I was introduced to this Coney. And the reason why I wanted to do a series on logic, instead of like taking it in its actual steps, like the first thing you do when you want to learn about a subject is you establish a background knowledge, information, getting your terms defined. Well, because of the way stuff comes at us, how information is presented to us or thrown at us, I think that it's important to have kind of an alarm system. So with Coney 2012, when I look at the presentation of that film, an alarm goes off for me. When I look at their rhetoric and the logical errors in the presentation of that film, it sends me on a quest to find out more about the facts, what's behind it. And that's a rewarding experience, because if you look at the amount of resources, like Coney, let's put Coney 2012 aside, the amount of resources and science and money and flashy graphics, like everything that goes into manipulating our emotions and shaping our opinions and ultimately determining our actions, we are up against an incredibly ominous force. Now, what I got here is I got a computer, I got some internet, I got the old YouTube, and through those simple tools, just by having what I would admit is a pretty basic understanding of these critical thinking principles, like I'm no expert on any of these subjects, but just with my basic, certainly above average understanding, but certainly not an expertise, I am able to defend myself against PhDs and millions of dollars, billions of dollars in campaigns that aim to control my thinking and my behavior, just with very limited resources, because I have a valuable self-defense tool. So the first reason why we're starting with logical fallacies is self-defense. If you are a young person, you know, I don't want to paint an overly negative picture here, but if you are a young person, I'm sorry, but you have targets all over you. There are people who are always trying to influence your values and your actions, your parents, your teachers, college professors, wait till you get a load of those people, your peers. You might have peers who are engaged in behavior or activities that is potentially self-destructive, and they want to pull other people into that. I'm not saying everybody, but I'm saying that this is certainly common. This is the idea of peer pressure, who want you to do that behavior too, so it normalizes it for them. And the reason why this peer pressure is so significant in school, in my opinion, is because this is a time where we're also getting some very strong and consistent messages on the importance of collectivism versus individualism, right? This is not a time to be out there on your own, right? So approval is very, very important. And feeling like what we're doing is normal is very, very important. You know, if you look at how people go to the mainstream media for the purpose of reinforcing what they already believe. Advertising is another great example of this, and of course political interests, probably the biggest and the most ominous. And they have tremendous resources and experts at their disposal. They craft strategies of influence, and those strategies of influence are often things, especially in the case of politics, that are urging you to act against your rational self-interest, what's really good for you. That gets thrown out, and they make these emotional appeals that have you pursuing behaviors that might not be what's best for you and your future. But that's the self-defense piece, but this is not just about detection and deflection. It's also about personal empowerment. It's about communication. It's about the logical organization of your thoughts and to be free of contradictions in your thinking. This was a very difficult thing for a long time in my life, where I would hear like Noam Chomsky say something about foreign policy, and then I'd hear William F. Buckley say something about economics, and I'd be like, oh yeah, they both make sense. But wait a minute, they fight each other. They're on television debating against each other. They're political adversaries. I don't get it. This was a long time ago. But I just found myself riddled with all of these ideological contradictions. But as time went on, and I mean, we're talking like when I started teaching other people, I was an extremely confused young man. You know, I had some things right, but I had a collage. You know, I didn't have a mind map. I didn't have something at the center holding it all together. And I didn't see how these different ideas worked together. And as time went on and I got more knowledge, I was also able eventually to be more rigorous about how I integrated and understood, you know, how it was related. And that really, really helped me, because at one time, folks, in my life, I did not have a lot of confidence in my intellectual abilities. And now it's at least gotten to a point where I can do a little podcast, and people seem to enjoy it, and people seem to think that the methods used to communicate this message, by and large, are effective. So great. It can certainly get better, but, you know, that's it. So we're going to get into the rest of this stuff on the show. So why start with logical fallacies? Because it's an alarm system. It's a very easy thing to spot in other people's presentations. And by having that alarm system and having a working knowledge of that, it provides us a tool for self-defense. And as we kind of take this and go to the larger topic of logic in general and other aspects of critical thinking, now that leads to a lot of empowerment, I've found. So today on the show, Richard Grove and Tony Myers, both from tragedyandhope.com, and we're going to be discussing their work on this subject. They do a lot of great work on this subject, and of course, their experience and success with its application. So that's it. I've got a lot of people that I want to mention as far as thanks go, but I'm going to wait for the next show. I want to get started on this one today. So here we go.
You know, the sheriff's got his problems too. He will surely take them out on you.
But the power and influence of the Freud family in America was about to grow even more. Politicians were about to turn to Edward Bernays for help in a time of crisis. He was going to manipulate the inner feelings and fears of the masses to help America's politicians fight the Cold War.
I don't mean to say, and no one can say to you, that there are no dangers. Of course there are risks if we are not vigilant. But we do not have to be hysterical.
In 1953, the Soviet Union exploded its first hydrogen bomb, and the fear of nuclear war and communism gripped the United States. those in power became concerned about how to reassure the population. Committees were set up and public information films made, appealing for calm in the face of new threats, like nuclear fallout. At this point, Edward Bernays was living in New York. In the 1920s, he had invented the profession of public relations, and was now one of the most powerful PR men in America. He worked for most of the major corporations and advised politicians, including President Eisenhower. Like his uncle Sigmund, Bernays was convinced that human beings were driven by irrational forces. The only way to deal with the public was to connect with their unconscious desires and fears. Bernays argued that instead of trying to reduce people's fear of communism, one should actually encourage and manipulate the fear, but in such a way as it became a weapon in the Cold War. Rational argument was fruitless.
What my father understood about groups is that they are manipulable, they're malleable, and that you can tap into their deepest desires or their deepest fears and use that to your own purposes. I don't think he felt that all those publics out there had reliable judgment, that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above.
One of Bernays's main clients was the giant United Fruit Company. They owned vast banana plantations in Guatemala in Central America. For decades, United Fruit had controlled the country through pliable dictators. It was known as a banana republic. But in 1950, a young officer, Colonel Arbenz, was elected president. He promised to remove United Fruit's control over the country. And in 1953, he announced the government would take over much of their land. It was a massively popular move, but a disaster for United Fruit. And they turned to Bernays to help get rid of Arbenz.
United Fruit brings in Bernays, and he basically understood that what United Fruit Company had to do was change this from being a popularly elected government that was doing some things that were good for the people there into this being very close to the American shore, a threat to American democracy, that it being at a time in the Cold War when Americans responded to issues of the Red Scare and what communism might do, he was trying to transform this and brilliantly did transform it into an issue of a communist threat very close to our shores, taking United Fruit again as a commercial client out of the picture and making it look like a question of American democracy, American values being threatened.
In reality, Arbenz was a democratic socialist with no links to Moscow. But Bernays set out to turn him into a communist threat to America. He organized a trip to Guatemala for influential American journalists. Few of them knew anything about the country or its politics. Bernays arranged for them to be entertained and to meet selected Guatemalan politicians who told them that Arbenz was a communist controlled by Moscow. During the trip, there was also a violent anti-American demonstration in the capital. Many of those who worked for United Fruit were convinced it had been organized by Bernays himself. He also created a fake independent news agency in America, called the Middle American Information Bureau. It bombarded the American media with press releases saying that Moscow was planning to use Guatemala as a beachhead to attack America. All of this had the desired effect.
In Guatemala, the Jacob Arbenz regime became increasingly communistic after its inauguration in 1951. Communists in the Congress and high governmental positions controlled major committees, labor and farm groups, and propaganda facilities. They agitated and led in demonstrations against neighboring countries and the United States.
What was profoundly new in terms of what Bernays did is he took this menace to our backyard in Guatemala. For the first time, we saw Reds a couple hundred miles from New Orleans, who Eddie Bernays had us believing were a true threat to us, that it was going to be a Soviet outpost in our backyard.
But what Bernays was doing was not just trying to blacken the Arbenz regime. He was part of a secret plot. President Eisenhower had agreed that America should topple the Arbenz government, but secretly. The CIA were instructed to organize a coup. Working with the United Fruit Company, the CIA trained and armed a rebel army. and found a new leader for the country called Colonel Armas. The CIA agent in charge was Howard Hunt, later one of the Watergate burglars.
What we wanted to do was have a terror campaign to terrify Arbenz particularly, terrify his troops, much as the German Stuka bombers terrified the population of Holland, Belgium, and Poland at the onset of World War II, and just rendered everybody paralyzed.
As planes flown by CIA pilots dropped bombs on Guatemala City, Edward Bernays carried on his propaganda campaign in the American press. He was preparing the American population to see this as the liberation of Guatemala by freedom fighters for democracy.
And so there has to be some skepticality of these types of reports. And I don't think we necessarily need to remind people just how important it is to be skeptical of all media reports in these times, especially when there seems to be a push towards rallying the public around a military intervention. But again, it has happened time and time and time and time again in recent history, even let alone longer periods of history. And we see it, unfortunately, perhaps coming to fruition again here in Syria.
And I mean, foreign media is relying on anonymous sources, pictures of journalists, pictures, poor quality pictures, I should say, shot at indistinguishable locations, really. And they're broadcast as real events. Do you think that's fair?
Certainly not. In fact, there's even been the implication that some of the images we're being shown have been digitally manipulated, and there have been reports about that available online that you can watch of footage that was taken in Bahrain and said to be taken in Hama, and is showing the same footage on different stations with different backgrounds digitally dropped in. So there are some very strange things that are going on right now, and unfortunately we live in an age where media manipulation is so easy that it starts to become more and more difficult to tell reality from fiction, especially when so much of the Western media is controlled by so few corporations. It does certainly raise at least the specter of that type of whole-scale manipulation. But of course, manipulation can be also much more subtle than that, and there are many different ways in which the media can steer a conversation towards the direction that the establishment wishes, from suppressing information that goes against the grain to amplifying information that seems to suggest whatever the establishment is looking for, to framing the conversation in a certain way. If we can frame the conversation to talk about whether or not we need military intervention to stop the Assad government, that takes away from the real conversation that should be going on about how people who are genuinely concerned about the Syrian people can be supporting the Syrian people in doing what they need to do in terms of their respecting their own national sovereignty and their borders, instead of just reliving Libya and staging a military intervention, which we have seen has greatly destabilized that country. So again, there's a lot of different ways that this works, but again, it is complicated by the fact that, of course, that there is not a freedom of movement among journalists in Syria. So it is difficult to put together these reports, and that has to be taken into account as well. So in some respects, perhaps the Assad government is doing it to itself.
Some international players, such as Turkey, for example, think the situation has reached a point where changes would be too little too late. Do you agree with that?
Well, it might have reached that point in terms of the conversation that's being framed. But once again, it's a question of how the question is being put to the public and what kind of information that's based on. And once again, I mean, there are many different ways that can be done. And it's not to say that the idea that information that's contrary to the official narrative of the Assad government attacking peaceful protesters is necessarily completely suppressed. Sometimes we see that. There was an April report from the AFP that showed that the U.S. State Department has been funding the Syrian opposition and opposition in other of these supposed spontaneous Arab uprisings to the tune of $50 million. And there was a report in the Washington Post earlier this year that showed that the Syrian opposition has been backed by the U.S. State Department. So sometimes this information comes out, but when it does, it's generally reported on and quickly forgotten, whereas anything that shows that even the suggestion that Assad is just killing killing people at random and willy-nilly in Syria is given a lot of amplification. So we see how that works, and then that changes the way that we can even look at the situation, whether it's too little, too late, and that sort of thing. It really depends on our understanding of what's happening in the country, which, again, is being completely framed by the media.
Just briefly now, the Syrian government says armed groups are to blame for instigating bloodshed during these demonstrations. Do you think that could be the case, or at least part of it?
Well, we certainly have to look at that possibility, especially when you ask yourself what possible reason the Assad government would have for attacking peaceful protesters while the scrutiny of the entire world is upon them. And the threat of military intervention is at least out there and on the table as these economic sanctions are closing in. What would be the point of this continued harsh crackdown? It does suggest that destabilization could be happening by armed snipers and others being inserted into these situations in order to blame on the Assad government. And if that's the case, then it certainly is working beautifully and is being reported on by Western media in a very unquizzical way. And that's why it's incumbent on the public to always be skeptical of these types of reports and to try to piece together things from many different sources.
All right. Some very interesting points. James Corbett, Osaka-based editor of the independent news website CorbettReport.com.
My guest on the show today, first of all, Richard Grove from TragedyAndHope.com. He is also the host of the Peace Revolution podcast and the producer of the Ultimate History Lesson, Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. Rich, how you doing?
I'm great, Brett. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And also with us, Tony Myers, who is the producer of the upcoming Tragedy and Hope series, History So It Doesn't Repeat. Tony, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Brad, how are you?
I'm great. I'm glad both of you guys are here for this very important introduction to a long overdue series on my show dealing with the topic of logical fallacies. So what we're hoping to do is provide you, the listener, with some valuable tools that will help with critical thinking, removing contradictions, and to borrow a phrase that I've heard Rich say in the past, getting a clear signal through all of the noise of whether or not you're still in school or you're exposing yourself for whatever reason to the mainstream media. But on my show in the past 2 years, we've spent a lot of time dealing with the ways that people come to be controlled. And of course, first and foremost, one of the most important is the demoralizing process of government schooling, where individual desire, volition, interests, autonomy are all compromised to essentially make people more or less servants of the status quo and the state. And another way that people come to be controlled is this bottlenecking, this occulting of a majority, almost all, historical, philosophical, psychological, and even practical knowledge. And there's a variety of channels through which that is done. Of course, the state education system, primary and secondary school, academia, the media, culture, psychology, and of course, society, where we have this horizontal policing where it's peers, it's family, it's friends who say, ooh, you know, maybe you shouldn't say that. But even though there's all these ways for controlling information or even preventing people from wanting to look for it, whatever creaks out or leaks out at the end is usually dealt with this sophism, and that's what we're going to get into next on this show. So this is the introduction to the series on logical fallacies, and just so we have a clear picture of what we're trying to do today, we just want to introduce this, talk about its practical values, some of the satisfaction that we've experienced. So, Tony, I'll start with you. You are actually the moderator, is that the proper word, for this logic group that you guys do every week? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could call me a moderator. I just kind of fell into the role. At Tragedy and Hope, there's a community there where we, as individuals, combined out of our own volition and decided that we wanted to learn the trivium, but yet, you know, we heard about it through Jan Urban's Gnostic Media podcast with Gino Denning, but we weren't quite sure how to go about learning it because much of the philosophical underpinnings of the trivium have been pretty much occulted or hidden away and reinterpreted over centuries from different philosophical perspectives. So we're trying to get to the heart of what exactly is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and how can we use this and employ this in our daily lives. So what happened was we had this moderator with the trivium study group. He fell out and no one else wanted to pick up the role. So I'm like, well, I have some extra time. And I figure I could, you know, I had some familiarity with it because I went to a parochial school when I was younger. And being in a Catholic environment, they did introduce some elements of logic and especially rhetoric. They really hounded rhetoric speeches and all these different sorts of things. We always had to go do something like of that nature.
But they give you prepackaged grammar or knowledge that you're not supposed to question.
Exactly. And they taught induction and deduction, but it was in a very broken form and understanding, and it was hard to apply it to our writing and our own rhetoric. So going from that perspective and having at least some familiarity, I just kind of fell in the position and just tried to help moderate the group. And it's tough for, you know, individuals to come along and have the time to kind of amalgamate all the resources needed and take the notes and try to help recapitulate and summarize and have an open discussion with the group each week.
It takes a lot of preparation, and many of us in a group just like to tune in and participate and, you know, do some light reading ahead of time. But what Tony does is a little more substantial. And that's why he's known as the moderator, even mm-hmm. though it's a bunch of individuals just trying to figure out what's going on.
Sure.
But the point you made earlier about occulting, and then Tony kind of defined, this is the whole secret to what they're doing. They hide useful information from other people. And when I say they, I mean the self-appointed ruling class, which, you know, you can define in a variety of ways. But let us just say it's not the people going through the public schools. So those of us who went through public schools or even parochial, like private schools, we've all found shortcomings and blind spots in these educations. And when you get into the actual definition of education, it is specifically the unocculting of information. It's the taking of this hidden information and making it useful to people. And so what we try to think of it, like the way we think about what we do, is that's purely what we're doing. We didn't really get into this thinking we were going to be, you know, in the education ourselves or trying to share and teach other people, but that's what it comes down to. It's the unocculting of information that we're sharing through the internet, and this is, you know, the purest type of education that we can form for ourselves. And we just thought it's useful to provide a space and take some time and effort to share it with other people as we go through the process of learning that which we should have learned a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked on my show in the past about the trivium, not in as much detail as I will in the future, but I always worry about the person who's tuning in for the first time. So do one of you want to give just a brief synopsis? And Tony, you did mention grammar, logic, and rhetoric, but can you just give us a basic synopsis on what the trivium is, where it went, why almost no one has heard of it, and in a nutshell, I know this is tough, but why it's valuable.
The trivium is a method of education, you could say, or method to coming to understand the world around you. And it's essentially, it's a three-step process that the mind naturally employs by taking in information via your percepts, your five senses, developing those into concepts, and then being able to communicate those concepts that we hold in our individual minds to other people. And therefore, we can communicate that which we know to exist around us, and that allows us to start building culture and start building language and these sorts of functions.
The word trivium in Latin means where three roads meet, and what those three roads are grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which is really knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. It's the identification of that which exists, which is the grammar or the knowledge. It's the removing of contradictions, which is the logic or the understanding. These are just two different terms for the same thing. And it's the communication or expression of that through action, which would be the rhetoric or wisdom. So it's input, processing, and output. And it's repeating that process consistently throughout your day while you're conscious.
So one of the reasons why I felt like this was the perfect time to deal with the logical fallacies piece of this is we have this presidential campaign going on right now. A lot of people are into this. I don't know if you guys have seen, but people are real excited about all different aspects of the 2012 presidential campaign, and I have tuned into some of it really for the purpose of preparing for this series. I did kind of a teaser episode involving one of these characters named Mitt Romney because I just couldn't resist listening to this man talk for 2 minutes and identifying almost 25 fallacies in what was just a statement about why he defended the National Defense Authorization Act. And I think that there's also a little bit of urgency in people having not just having for themselves, but also being able to identify and share some tools of intellectual self-defense. And maybe like this is a good time when the mainstream media is so flooded with so many examples. I mean, one Republican debate could be turned into a logical fallacies textbook. Almost everything would be covered. That this was a perfect time to start getting some of this terminology and some discussion about the importance of being able to identify, to recognize, and to communicate these things to other people, this was a good time to do that.
Well, how would learning the fallacies, I mean, it sounds boring to me. How would that help an individual listening to this podcast right now?
Well, we put that in perspective. when we hear all these clever, you know, rhetoricians, these different politicians having these so-called debates, first of all, I'd like just to pay attention to how people react in the audience. Is there any emotion being portrayed? What's being said? You know, all these different things that we recognize that they're saying. These relate back to ways of thinking, ways of arguing, the ways we use terms to relate that which we understand in our own minds and hearts. And these terms, if not used correctly, can become fallacious. And these fallacies are, for the most part, self-evident. They're very commonsensical. Yet, you know, once you make them explicit, it's much easier to point it out and then go and ask the question, well, why would that person use a fallacy? Are they using it nescently, not quite knowing exactly that they're using a fallacy and that they're meaning to portray any form of harm or coercion? Or are they using it in such a way that they do intend harm or coercion? Mental harm, physical harm, you know, these are different forms, but nonetheless, it's a mental form of harm when they use it in that
Context. You have to determine whether or not they're using it as a way to take away your volition and your free will, or if they're trying, you know, it's nescient and it's not purposeful, and you know, the fact that they do it, it's not something that's trying to hurt you. So if you look at, like, let's look at the debates in general before we even get to the fallacies. The fallacies are ways that they're trying to deceive you. That's what it means. It comes from the Latin fallere and noun and verb form. So there can be a deception, or they can use it as a verb to deceive, right? So the idea of a fallacy, it indicates a logical error in the processing of thoughts. It includes contradictions, and you want to remove the contradictions. And so that's the whole idea of identifying when people are using fallacies and why you want to remove them so you don't get tricked. But if you look at the debates in general, let's just take a consideration. You have multi-billion dollar companies creating an artificial terrarium where they selectively put people in the audience, and then they selectively, you know, give these questions that everyone's read ahead of time, and there's no real debate going on. It's a change in nomenclature. If you look up the definition of debate, it's not what you're seeing on TV that they call a debate. And so it's because the audience doesn't have the awareness to know the difference between a real debate and this, you know, hour and a half long commercial they're seeing for the advertised products of the ranchers who manage this ranch. I mean, that's all it is. It's like, vote for your rancher because it's still going to be a ranch afterwards. You know, this is like Animal Farm.
Right. These proceedings start where every candidate, maybe with the exception of Ron Paul, because some of the things that he says are relatively controversial within the mainstream of the people who are in the audience there. But the other guys know that they're just preaching to an emotion-driven choir already. So, like, the logic is precluded from this. There is no need for them to adhere to rules of logic because that's not even an expectation of the audience anymore.
You know, right, and it's one step worse. They're refusing to do any real observation. So if someone like Ron Paul does bring up a fact that's not being officially sponsored by, you know, the people bringing you that program, then they're not going to really address it, and people act like it doesn't exist and all these other things that go on. So really, you're seeing a highly refined, scripted product brought to you by hundreds and hundreds of people and costing enormous amounts of money. Why? Because they can't just tell you the truth. Mitt Romney can't just say, hey, I support this because we want to bomb these people and take away their oil or their natural resources or whatever. So they have to come up with very clever ways to trick you. Why? Because if they told you the truth and you knew what they were really doing, you wouldn't support it. And why is that? Because you're not innately or genetically an awful human being who's a natural predator. You're someone who just wants to get along and learn what they have to do to, you know, survive and thrive in this world without taking away someone else's free will, without the violation of volition. This is the principle of non-aggression. And it makes sense. It's logical and reasonable not to prey on other people. And the people we don't prey on, those are our friends and family. That's who we call friends. It means that this person won't eat me, right? Because coming from the days of pre-civilization, those are the people you want to stick around with, other people who won't kill you and eat you. And then everyone else is kind of known as the opposition or the enemy. And thus people are trying to like churn out their living, foraging and doing all these things in a pre-civilization sense. And it's only because of cause and effect and reason and cooperation and communication between people that anything that we see today could exist. I mean, even if it's in a shattered and tattered form that we can greatly improve upon, we still have to recognize that we stand on the shoulders of giants and all this prehistory that got us to the point where we could even have this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just to step back there for a minute, one of the things that I remember in listening to your interview, Rich, with Jonathan Taylor Gatto was he was saying that he believed that our current president had been trained in techniques of deception.
Yeah.
When you listen, and Tony as well, when you guys listen to these current contenders for this you know, rancher job talking, does it seem like we take somebody like Romney, for example, does it seem like he just has so much experience in being deceptive through his corporate and his political career that this is almost just natural for them? Or are you seeing any signals based on your knowledge of the fallacies and of the trivium? Do you see any signals that these guys are actually schooled in techniques of deception the way Gatto said Obama likely was? Or do you just think that this has, I don't want to say that's come natural, but they're just very, very practiced at it from their long political and corporate careers?
My opinion, and I'll let Tony answer, I would say they're not as highly technically trained, and that Obama does have a special family history that gives him some unique abilities, and that Romney is basically leveraging the community of, you know, his religious community and his corporate experience to bring all those tools of persuasion to bear.
Mm-hmm.
I'll look up where Romney went to school.
Yeah, but I would say that they're technically trained insofar as to use words and phrases cleverly enough to be deceptive. And yes, I do say they're using it deceptively and we're trained that way. But also, they many times these politicians come from wealth and are kind of born into situations that they want to justify in the first place.
Sure.
Whatever family business, you know, whoever helped them to get in the position that they find themselves now. You know, they want to help bolster that own philosophy. So in a way, I think it's when you use fallacies knowingly, you kind of just, I don't know how these people do it. Because one, they're trained in rhetoric, but they have a prepackaged grammar. So they kind of justify it on what someone else said. If it's a scientific debate, if it has something to do about abortion or GMOs or whatever crazy topic comes up, it's always the same topics too, right?
I just applied the trivium to your question because my answer at the beginning is, I only know what I've seen thus far, but let me take a closer look. So you want to do the first step, which is grammar. So grammar, you're going to look for a dictionary or an encyclopedia or some other reference source that you can get some reliable, just basic facts, right? So I'm using Wikipedia, and the first thing everyone's going to say is, oh, Wikipedia, it doesn't give you, well, I'm looking for basic facts. I'm not saying everything on this page is accurate. I just want to know where he went to school. These things are usually accurate at that.
Sure.
And when I see that he's the son of George Romney, former governor of Michigan. So his dad was a governor. He is a Mormon missionary. He has a joint JD and MBA from Harvard, which means he's a lawyer. And the MBA school at Harvard trains in Machiavellian techniques. And that he's also a lawyer. So that's also the use, sophisticated use of words to not look for objective truth, but to find ways around it.
How many politicians are lawyers?
Now, I knew that he had this JD from Harvard. So that is essentially this training in this sophistry, in this deception, in this sort of baseless techniques, as far as logic is concerned, baseless techniques in persuasion. That's
well, and what is Bain Capital? Bain Capital is murders and executions. I mean, mergers and acquisitions.
Right. So, Tony,
I quoted Patrick Bateman from American Psycho.
Tony, I want to just jump back to something that you were saying a minute ago when you were saying that these people have a pre-packaged grammar. Could you expound on that a little bit and tell us just what you mean by that?
Sure. The idea is that these people are instilled with a preset data set, if you will. And so they're given already the definitions to certain philosophies, certain terms that would be used in sophisticated argumentation. They're given all of this as a prepackaged form. So they're taught to learn it. Well, they're taught to learn it just verbatim, kind of how you would memorize it. Then from there, they take the techniques and they go into kind of the conceptual ideas of the techniques, the way they express some of these ideas that they're already justifying when they're getting from the very young. So oftentimes we find these wealthy men of science or philosophy trying to justify many times the ventures of either their family or, you know, the philosophy of the religion to which they belong. I know Gatto, I believe, mentioned Calvinism, all these different forms of Protestantism which broke off, and
yep.
You know, King Henry VIII as well. So we look at all these different paths. A lot of these things, they seem to use logic to justify why they're doing certain actions. And it's funny because they continually use it in a way to coerce, where in fact that's contradictory by nature. So
I can also just add a little perspective
sure.
that might help clarify that, because it's like muddy water that we really need to filter right this moment before we even go on. And I would suggest that it's this, that belief systems are, they act as counterfeit knowledge. So you're not going based on experience and what exists. You're going on, this person wrote a book, and this book is truth, and it's truth because this person wrote this book. It gets into all this circular reasoning, right? And so what it turns out is it's counterfeit knowledge, which is accepted as truth. So it's illusion accepted as truth, and that is unquestioned. And that's the first step, that knowledge step. And then it just goes about organizing and reorganizing this thing that you're assuming is truth when there's, you know, it lacks evidence, right? And so it's whether it's the Jesuits or the Mormons or any number of other secret societies who occult useful information, they then give you this other prepackaged indoctrination. And it's exactly how you use the natural methods of the mind, which are encapsulated in the trivium, to control people instead of liberate them. So the liberation comes from using your own five senses that God gave you, using your own mind that God gave you, if you believe in that, right? And I happen to believe that, you know, if you can be conscious and understand what reason is, that's all the proof of God I really need. All these other descriptions kind of fail me. These other things that are purported, you know, holy scripts, I don't really buy into all that. But what I do buy into is consciousness and being aware of that which exists and learning from cause and effect and employing useful tools like reason and communication. These things I can stand on that and believe in it and use it to my own survival every day, right? And when people say there's evil going on, it's really just the absence of reason. There's irrationality running rampant. That's where you would say God doesn't exist there and it's a godless land. Oh, because reason's not there? That's interesting how they kind of just change these words around and, you know, consciousness becomes this thing that, you know, turns into an authority figure somehow. I don't know.
What do you mean?
A very vengeful authority figure in the Bible.
What do you mean by God?
Oh, dude, that's a whole other show. I wasn't asserting any belief. I was just observing that I don't know everything yet. I am as of yet unfinished and still learning. That's all. Okay. I'm just accounting for the unknown that, you know, exists beyond reason.
Right. We'll state it from Aristotle's position that what exists is just what is nature. So we start from that vantage point and say there's no contradictions in nature, and then we'd use logic as a filter to try to understand that which exists in nature. And so it's just kind of a natural function that we humans have.
And these are healthy questions to ask, because if you don't ask them, you're going to end up under the... It's not so much mind control or brainwashing so much as it is values change of different religions. And religions are religions because they are not direct experiences anymore. They've put proxies in. And so some priest has the direct experience of a sacrament and then tells everyone else about it. And I don't believe in that way of doing business here as a human being.
Sure.
Argumentum ad ignorantium, right?
Well, I think what we're seeing too, going back to the original question I asked Tony, is that these people have this grammar that's built on fallacies.
Right.
The argument from authority, the appeal to tradition, even the appeal to popularity or popular opinion, even though it's kind of like, I know the appeal to popular opinion would be to say, well, this is just because 75% of people think so. But it also, I think, can be summed up in, this is what the people in our neighborhood do, and this is what people like us, this is what the expectations for our class or whatever.
And I think it's our job to challenge those.
Sure.
And once you understand more, like, you know, I started learning fallacies, like I started studying them one a day, and then I would just try to go around and see where I could see it. And I noticed that it was kind of slow going until I noticed four or five fallacies, and then you could start noticing them in groups and the complexity of when people like Romney or any other, you know, sophisticatedly trained person who's trying to influence you and take authority over you. These are the tools of how they control people. And it's a values change that they use by using words in such a way that it doesn't reflect reality. And whether it's an appeal to emotion or the patriotic appeal or using fear or threat of violence, which is an ad baculum fallacy. So that, like, if we just go down the different actions, you'd be like, well, I see these things all over the place. What you're missing is the explicit nomenclature that allows you to identify those fallacies clearly and truly be able to communicate to someone and not just say, well, I read that article and it's very convincing, but I sense that there's something wrong to it. And I just go with my gut that I'm not going to believe it. Well, there's some uncertainty there. Wouldn't you rather have a tool that delivers a higher level of certainty and allows you to make decisions that lead to serenity and less regret? And I'm not talking about any magical religious thing. It's just knowing how to use your own mind. And this is what every secret society on this planet has eventually, like, it's what their deepest secrets are. It's all about how to use your mind and prevent other people from learning how to use theirs. It's the only game that's ever gone on in humanity. That's the game we're playing right now. can we learn to use our minds better than the people who are trying to keep us in cages using their minds? Like, once you can take confusion and chaos and make it into order through a process of learning, like order out of chaos, that nebulous phrase that's associated with Albert Pike, and all, that's about learning. The last secret in his book is all about learning. And so you don't have to become a Mason. You don't have to give an oath, because that's giving away your free will at sometime in the future when you're going to want it back. So I don't advise joining any of these clubs or buying into those beliefs or those control structures, but I do have an awareness that they exist, and that if they are our opposition trying to enslave us, that we need to know as much about them and understand our opposition such that we can make their model obsolete.
And I just want to add a point that although these politicians seem like they're, you know, spouting sophisticated rhetoric, in fact, much like you pointed out, Brad, how many fallacies did Mitt Romney in fact have within that segment? Was like 20, 25
in 2 minutes or something like that, which is like 12 point something per minute.
So it's not even, it's really an effective media culture, quick cuts and just a quick change of subject and these sorts of things. But, you know, it's not very sophisticated insofar as, or if you contrast that to someone like someone in the science, in the position of like a scientific journal where they can filter in knowledge. And in that position, they tend to use a lot of truths and then present some fallacious rhetoric a little bit through. When you've already kind of like given in to the fact that they're expounding a lot of truth and you're kind of settled in, that's to me is someone who's sophisticated in rhetoric. But someone who just expounds fallacy after fallacy, it's just, that's more of just like a game or just a show they're putting on.
So I think that's worth repeating, too, is that you're saying that, and you could probably see this in the debates as well, and I think if we shifted, because I know there's people who at least know people who are involved in this. Now, here in New Hampshire, there's a big sort of Ron Paul support movement. I am in many ways very, very opposed to that for a variety of reasons, obviously, which I don't think we need to get into here, but we see the sophistication of somebody like, say, the other guy, Gingrich. Now, one of the reasons why I think this is important is because you could have some dialogue about politics with somebody who might be a voter and might still be very invested in believing in this system. And it's one thing to say to somebody, don't you see how full of shit this guy is? But it's another thing to be able to basically deconstruct 1 or 2 minutes very effectively of them trying to slither their way away from answering a very important question. I think that that makes a much more effective presentation. So I encourage people to watch some of this stuff, to learn these things. This is a great opportunity to be learning this stuff right now and sharing it with other people. But what Tony just brought up, I think, is a whole different level of sophistry, and it's far more sophisticated than what we saw Romney doing in the video or in the audio that I just put out as a sort of teaser to this series. So, Tony, if I heard you correctly, what you're saying is that you can say a variety, almost get a running start, almost build momentum of agreed upon truths, even objective truths, and then just for my big finale, here's the huge lie, and because of the momentum, you buy it. Does that make sense?
Yep, that makes perfect sense. And in fact, you know, a lot of play structures are based on this, you know, the 5-part play or the 3-act play, you know, these sorts of frameworks or methods that we use to construct plays and these sorts of things. In fact, you know, they're based on that kind of framework. So you can build up a whole sort of dialogue and expound that to a group and present, really the idea is to present a lot of truths, get people already believing and agreeing with you. So when you already get them on that mindset of agreeing with you, then you just present something that's just way out there, something they believe they can't hold on to. They can't understand that, of course, the person in the front of the room.
It's a leap of faith. You're sending them to a cliff, exactly. And it's a leap of faith. And I disagree with that wholeheartedly and think it's one of the most unuseful things that's been passed along in human history, because we've all been subject to it, because all of our decisions have been made under the fallacy of the neglected aspects, which have all been occulted by these people who got here first, formed groups that are multi-generational, and thereby we keep continually being born into a terrarium that's got a clean slate, and it's like, hey, you live in America, it's only existed for 200 years, no other history before that's really relevant.
Right.
Pledge allegiance to the flag before you can learn how to talk. It's called a chant. Just start chanting these words, and you know, you'll figure it out later. when you're getting shot at.
And I think it goes to say, you know, something to our culture and what God is pointing to, the fact that people have been schooled on this to extinction.
Extinction, yeah.
I mean, that's really what's going on, because the fact that, you know, you can point out 25 fallacies in 2 minutes, much like when Jan Ervin did Obama when he gave his press conference about the
Osama bin Laden being allegedly
caught
by the SEALs.
Right, all these different fallacies pop up, and people, I think, innately kind of realize that they're being lied to. But this is where we get to the idea that once you can dissect it, once you can make it explicit, something happens with the mind. When you label it and start dissecting it, all of a sudden you start asking more questions. You go deeper. Well, why would that person be using it, you know, a fallacy in that way? Why? What are they trying to prevent me from understanding? They're very sophisticated arguments, because they need to be, because logic's pretty commonsensical. Yeah. You know, it's a fairly common, a simple process. You know,
what common sense is the natural affinity for people to organize their thoughts and to remove contradictions. And the trivium is just man noticing man's own tendency of man's own mind and saying, hey, there's a useful three-step input, processing, and output that makes effective decision-making, and that's it.
And to bring it back to, you know, what Gatto said, in the very beginning of the documentary when we filmed it, I believe he said, I argue with myself by writing down what I think I believe. And then he goes about, you know, handwriting it and goes through all these different drafts and copies about what he thinks he believes and just continually arguing with himself. And it's ironic, because what we're trying to push at Tragedy and Hope is the trivium, just in a method of education, a method to coming to understanding a lot of these anomalous dots that we see, these tips of the iceberg that need to be explored. But, you know, they can't be explored without a method, without pertaining back to objective reality, objective truth. And so therefore you do need a method. And logic's been the main method used throughout a couple of millennia now.
But logic alone isn't enough.
To analyze all philosophies.
It has to be used in a method, an integrated method that does certain things. Otherwise you're going to get errors all the time. And the idea is to get error-free thinking. And that's what a fallacy is. It's just it's an error. And if you notice in your own thinking, you can remove it. If you notice in someone else's thinking, there's various polite ways of bringing it up and addressing it and, you know, getting them to be interested, because I would think you would want to be cogently and clearly and comprehensively communicating freely as a role of survival and thriving in this world. So I could definitely see the skills in instilling yourself with rhetorical, you know, prowess. But I would say that it doesn't match anyone who also has the knowledge and understanding before you try to express that as wisdom, because it's going to be shown for the errors that it contains.
Right.
And that's the prophet. I mean, anytime someone's making a declarative sentence, that technically is an argument. And so if there's an argument, you're seeking proof. And so you have to define the terms, and are the terms clear? Are the premises true? And if those two are congruent, then you can have a valid argument. But so many times there are arguments set forth that don't have clear terms and don't have true premises. And what that tells me is that the person making the argument either doesn't care about being clear and actually making an argument, or, like, you know, so they're nescient of it, not a big deal. Or they clearly know, like Romney, that his terms can be ambiguous. He can use equivocation. He can use premises which are not true because he uses the fallacy of neglected aspect. And his argument is therefore consistently invalid. You can apply a neglected aspect to almost everything that any president says, because they're always trying to push you toward a conclusion that is irrational if you were given all the items on the table and not just, here's this little select view of what's going on.
So that is essentially an omission similar to stacking the deck, which we were talking about before, where you're trying to line up, put everything in your favor, to tip a scale towards your side of the argument, completely omitting all of the other options. And the reason why I just want to emphasize that right there is people are told, and people come to believe through schooling and culture and media, that the only way that the world will ever change, that will ever become the better place that everybody wants it to be, even though they have different definitions and different visions of what that should be, is through the state, is through authority, is through begging leaders and rulers to make the world a better place. Please use the force of the government to manifest my will into reality. You know?
Sounds like a god.
Sounds like an artificial god. And sounds like a religion that you're pushing.
We see so much anger and animosity in this political arena, but people are told that this is where they have to be if they care about making the world, quote unquote, better. And all that we ever see is it get worse and worse and worse. And at the same time, we are, our whole lives, this myth is being constructed through our schooling of the benevolent state and the helpful state and the omniscient state. And
when people get into this political arena and then they get this revolutionary thinking, I think they become very dangerous. And I think that, you know, applying the violent ideations of politics to like really fast changes, like let's change things now through violence. So I think revolutionary thinking is something that comes out of political thinking. But what we have here, what we've talked about with the trivium and understanding these fallacies is these people are putting out all of this material and we have the tools to basically destroy it peacefully.
That's right. And what we're talking about is a peaceful revolution of the mind. It's not a physical revolution. It's a turnabout in perspective, meaning you've been taught your whole life through public schooling only to look forward. And I'm just saying, take one full turn around, look at all this other stuff, and now come back to your forward-thinking perspective, now with a sense of everything around you. You've eliminated your blind spots, right? And so to someone who glorifies the state or thinks that we can't do without the state, I have a new word for you. I learned this word earlier today, or maybe it was yesterday, in watching this this new documentary film. The word is democide. And I'd been looking for this word. I had seen the effects of democide everywhere, but I didn't have a word. I didn't have the nomenclature to identify it clearly to pass it on to you. But it's the notion of this. The greatest threat to humanity has been death by government. And yep. That's historically provable. And so we have to observe that that's not the best way to do things and that we can innovate our way out of that only once we understand these so-called problems. We get knowledge together, and now it's not a problem, because once you understand the problem, it becomes the solution. What you're missing is that additional information that it took John years and years and years to go get, and he collects it, and he, you know, purveys it out through this interview. But I'd also say that's the same reason he argues with himself, because he knows what he's programmed to think is not the accurate perspective that he could have if he actually goes through, does the work of asking himself questions and goes through the work of finding the valid answers and does that over and over again to refine something. And that's not something you can get from a psychic power, and it's not something you can get from anyone else and just buy it. It's something you have to learn to work through yourself and do that consistently through everything. And you should have a sense of, you know, where everything around you came from and understand the grammar, logic, and rhetoric of each subject, of each, you know, substance in your surroundings, because that's what builds true self-confidence. When you understand yourself as juxtaposed to your surroundings, that's the epitome of understanding and cool, calm, collected behavior. No need to panic, no need to shout and use fear and all these other types of manipulative rhetoric. However, if you take the most confident person and put them in an environment that they're not familiar with and it's chaotic and confusing and they don't have a method to make, you know, to make some order out of that by learning, then it's going to be, he's, you know, there's no confidence there.
Well, I think it's the idea of system dynamics. Essentially, they rationalize that they have to create these systems for us to, you know, keep us organized and in these habitual patterns, because that's
the
great
flywheel.
What
would we do without the census?
But really, that's the key, you know. Once they get us into these systems, that's why people find it so hard, one, to either go into the system and try to attack it from within, or to try to step outside of it. It's nearly impossible because of the way we use money and, you know, our current economic system. So, you know, we find it very difficult to break these habits because we're kind of forced into them coercively, especially by the credit system, I think just comes to mind right now. But, you know, that's one, I believe it was Alexander James Inglis, you know, one of the functions of schooling, you know, the adjustive function, I believe.
That's in hour five, Brett. You haven't gotten to it, maybe.
No, and I don't think I have yet. I'm not very familiar with Alexander Inglis and his six functions of compulsory schooling. I think I've talked about that on my show a couple times in the past. So, and I think Gatto mentions that probably in the first thing that I ever read by him, which was a piece in Harper's called Against Schooling. And I
Right.
And that to everybody.
Lewis Lapham.
It's a very, very succinct and concise introduction to all of this stuff that he goes into great detail on in the Ultimate History Lesson, and of course in the Underground History book. So that's a good just add. It's I mean, it's still a pretty long article, but it compared to the Ultimate History Lesson or the Underground History,
it's brief in that aspect.
It's an
comparison.
Yeah, it's an abstract of these ideas. So
the other thing I wanted to mention is that for your audience to have some good resources on understanding fallacies, on learning fallacies, I'm going to throw out the primary source, which leads to many of the current sources. So I'll throw out Aristotle's book. It's called On Sophistical Refutations. But really, it's just saying people who don't know how to use logic also try to justify what they want in other ways. And here are those errors that they use. So you can defend yourself intellectually
from people who don't know how to get what they want using logic and reason, and thus uncreatively try to prey on you. And the fewer people that are out there that can be preyed upon, the fewer people that can give their energy away consistently to this group which seeks to enslave all of us and really to terminate and make, you know, humanity extinct.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff saves, logic saves lives. If you listen to what these pushers are trying to push and how quickly people are buying it up and ingesting it and consuming it, it's not going anywhere good. And we can tie this to the current events of today, the current events of 5 years ago. What has been sold to the public through this sophistry has put a lot of people into graves in a variety of different ways.
Well, let's just take the Iraq War. I mean, in my mind, it's Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations that gets everybody to say, well, they got those mobile units. We got to get them. Right now, understanding that and watching it with the method of the trivium, you know, actively exercised in my brain every day, it is just so, like, before I knew there was something wrong and that he was lying, but now I can just call it out and dissect it in such a way that once you show it to other people, they're like, wow, yeah, that's that. Okay, I get you. Now you can clearly and cogently communicate, whereas before it's just a gap, and that's what they use. That's where the power and information gap, the money gap all comes from. It's our inability to clearly and cogently and comprehensively communicate with each other.
And there's a lot of practical personal value in this too, and personal satisfaction and empowerment.
But it is important to understand that when you're not using that consistently, you can easily fall into confusion, fear, frustration, aggression, violence, all these things that are so prevalent to getting people killed. So I like to look at it like this. In a Maslow's hierarchy of needs type of way, picture yourself out in the wilderness, you know, 1,000 miles away from civilization, and now you have to figure out how to protect yourself from the elements, protect yourself from predators, find food, find water, you know, make fire, all these things. You will absolutely need this process to survive. You have to remain calm, and the only way you can remain calm in a situation of unknown is to have a method of dealing with the unknown and have the powers of logic and reason and creativity at your disposal. That is how mankind got so far as to make civilization in the first place, right? And now we have to juxtapose that to where we are. Oh, we live in these artificial towns or suburbs or cities, these places where we don't, the food that's grown that we're eating is thousands of miles away in some cases, and we're highly dependent on the infrastructure and electricity and all these other things, the grocery stores, in order to survive. And now there are people who look like us. They're not like bears and wolves trying to eat us. There are people who look like us and talk like us who are willing to lie and give us false information. And we, being so trusting and normal, average human beings, we must recognize that these predators exist, and they use words in most cases to prey on us, not violence. Words are used to prey on people in 99% of the cases, right? And so you're getting preyed on intellectually all day. You might only get in a fist fight every now and then. You see what I'm saying? And so they've moved from physical oppression, because it's too high cost per slave to manage people like that, and they've used the Beatrice Webb. Kill them with kindness, give them a lot of what they think is freedom here in America, but really we were just selling out our own future by operating with an economy like that.
Sure, right? These predators will even smile at you and maybe say something kind of
flattering. And they're planning, and they plan over decades and centuries, not like day to day like most people are thinking. Like, these people have had a coherent plan. They've published it in numerous, numerous books. We have archives from the Council on Foreign Relations roundtable meetings that prove up and down, like, this stuff goes on, it's real, they're really doing this, and the only people who don't know about it are the people who are using words like conspiracy theory, and that phrase wasn't even in the dictionary until 1996 or 1997, after that film came out. So yeah. It was, they had to introduce it to the vernacular through popular culture, make a big film about it, and put Mel Gibson in it, that gets it into the popular culture, and now when people parrot that back, it's called cynicism, when you don't know what you're saying and you're just repeating it to other people because you think it makes you sound cool. They just say, oh, well, it's conspiracy theory. Let's break those two words down. Conspiracy. So a group of people planning to prey on somebody else and not give them a heads up. So that goes on all the time. And a theory only is a theory until there is facts and evidence to back it up. And then it's a hypothesis. And then when you can repeat it and can't break that hypothesis, that is, you know, the epitome of certainty.
And as Gatto said, as you have said, and, you know, all the people in your community who do your podcast with you, and, of course, Carol Quigley has said, you see this same pattern talking about proving a hypothesis over and over and over again.
Yeah, my job is to make and break hypotheses until I can get to one that I can't break. And that's the same thing Gatto's describing in his own way about writing it out and arguing with himself. And we all have this ability to do this implicitly. And it's not until we all get together and say, oh, you do that sort of thing. I call it this. You call it that. Hey, look, we call it the trivium. Now we're all inputting, processing, and outputting. And we just call it this thing so we can talk about it. But we're all doing it already. Like, I was using the trivium method before, you know, decades before I ever found out about it, just because I have a sense of contradictions and that doesn't fit over there. And, it, you know, putting puzzles together. That's, we're all innately wired like that. Mm-hmm. It's just an explicit, you know, nomenclature so we can talk about it and get useful things done.
All right. Make it fundamental. Bring it back to the fundamentals, in fact, that because we are human, this is our innate ability to get use ratio, to compare and contrast the things that we perceive and then develop concepts and communicate that. That's something we do naturally. It's just developing that process and making it explicit. And then the rhetoric stage, the communication, once we've developed that grammar, amalgamated that knowledge, taken out the contradictions through logic, once you reach that rhetoric stage, that's where that confidence comes in. I can say, you know, helping out with the logic group, now I barely even moderate or do much, really. Most of the people now participate and willingly speak up when they want to, and we're all helping each other out now. It just took, you know, a bit of time to go through some of the basic concepts, and this is just something we do naturally. It's just about making it explicit and making it coherent so that we can communicate to other people. And I notice over time is that more confidence, the biggest thing that really is developing in people, I believe, is confidence, because they're becoming more confident in their ability to discern truth from fiction and the lies that are being told to us, and then being able to actually finally coherently communicate that, which, you know, for all of us struggle with friends and family, especially friends and family, because they've known us for so long and they've, you know, went through the experiences that we went through, going through so many different ideas and watching us go through so many different philosophies and experiences. So it's difficult to sometimes get through to them. But, you know, if we can put it back in perspective and just get back to something that's commonsensical, something that we can objectively verify, and just being able to compassionately communicate to other people and not use any form of coercive rhetoric or, you know, try to mislead anyone. We're just trying to all get here, you know, try to get to the truth and, you know, try to understand exactly these systems in place that are preventing us really from just being free, sovereign, autonomous individuals.
Excellent.
The idea would be like this. Fallacies are a way to plant a deception for you to fall into or to deceive you outright. So it's not in your best interest to fall into this idea of illusions as cast by somebody else. You have the free will not to believe and to ask questions. And so in order to go about in a fallacy-free way conducting your life, you have many topics and many different activities that come up that you have to check out. And, you know, someone could call you on the phone and make you an offer, you know, about some long-distance company. You should figure out who that long-distance company is and what you're paying now, and are there any hidden fees and all these things to protect yourself in any given situation of human interaction. So you'd wanted to identify the topic, and you're seeking to understand this topic. And how do you understand but, you know, taking what exists, removing the contradictions? That's the illusion, because illusions also exist until you remove them, right? Mm-hmm. I've identified the illusions. I removed them. Now all I'm left with is that which objectively exists in reality. And that's substance, and I can do stuff with substance. So the idea is, you know, you're applying a filter that's going to remove the noise. It's going to leave the signal. And you do that by defining your terms, having clear premises, and using, you know, arguments to figure it out with yourself. You don't have to argue with another person. You can use this process internally. It's called autodidactic, where you're teaching yourself. And so we're not trying to tell people what to think. We're really just trying to provide the tools we've found that help you to effectively think. And the process of thinking is really nothing more than the process of non-contradictory identification, which is also logic.
So one more question I have before we wrap up. This might be kind of a difficult one, but it's a real challenge, we know, and Tony just touched on this, when we talk with friends, when we talk with family who are unfamiliar with these ideas, to in any kind of expedient way let go of a belief system that they are very comfortable with, or even a certain part of a belief system sometimes, if that piece of supposed knowledge is sort of at the foundation of that belief system or close to the foundation of that belief system. Have either of you ever had this experience where...
Sorry for laughing.
No, that's great. Exciting. No. Why? But
you, well, are... you know, I think everyone, it's also phases that we all go through in learning how to communicate effectively with other, you know, conscious adults.
Yeah.
Because there are people who will laugh. If you're using reason and people laugh at you and they appeal to laughter, which is a fallacy, it just shows that they're intellectually bankrupt and you should really move on if you're looking for knowledge, because you're not going to get it there. Right? On the other hand, there's like the whole process of trying to explain to your friends and family and trying to provide this information for their own safety so that they don't take, so that they're not taken advantage of, so that they can truly use their mind and decide what they want to do with their life instead of acting out someone else's script. And that is wholly done through some trial and error. And the more work you do on yourself, the less trial and error you'll have. So you need to identify the fallacies in your own thinking. And then you need to be able to speak and communicate with diffidence. Like, you can't go around just, you know, telling people that they're, you're using fallacies and calling names, and that doesn't really help constructively. It's not compassionate. It's not, you know, not meaningful in any way. But you can go, you know, and have these conversations and politely, I mean, this is what I found after experience. I did it the wrong ways. And do you want to hear about all those, or do you want to hear about how you can be effective in communicating?
Well, my question was going to be, but this is a much better direction. Maybe we could talk about this whole other subject some other time. Have you ever had to, after applying these tools to a certain something that you were pretty confident about, have you ever had to let go of it? But I think at this point, it's far more useful for you to, because I made a small kind of hobby out of going about approaching people the wrong way. And I got some funny material out of it for my show, but it didn't produce much productive dialogue. And it certainly didn't produce many significant changes in other people's thinking or other.
That is a much better question. And my answer would be, nothing I was conditioned or indoctrinated to believe in has survived the process.
All right.
That's the beauty of using reason. Because it's really just
I had really good reasons to give up my beliefs. I had really good reasons to give up my beliefs. That's what I'll say to people.
There you go.
Is that if you're challenged, if you have a belief and someone's presenting evidence and it challenges your belief, I came to the decision for myself that it does not help me to believe in things that are not true, and it does not help me to separate myself from reality. It doesn't help me in any way to dismiss credible evidence without observing it and integrating its usefulness. So I just learned to stop handicapping myself belief is kind of like you're on a journey to knowledge, and belief's like a midpoint. It's a rest stop. And belief, when you take it as knowledge, it's thinking that the rest stop is your destination. Right?
Right.
And so I'm just saying, get up, go the rest of the way, do the work, do the learning, figure out what's really going on. It's much more historically interesting and intrinsically interesting as a human being in this human experience than what you believe in to start with. Because what I found out was that as growing up as a Presbyterian, that I believed and loved Jesus so much that the questions I had, I wasn't satisfied with the answers I got in church. And then I started reading books. And after you read books like Some Mistakes of Moses or, you know, any of these other books that are bringing out the historicity and the contradictions, the fallacies in what I had been taught before I could even think for myself, and I had accepted as my, you know, that's me. No, that wasn't part of me. I don't include illusions in me anymore because I have the choice now to discern between fiction and the reality, and I can choose reality. But at least I gave myself the choice, and I took that leap of faith back then to walk into the fear. And after wandering around confused and fear for a couple of years, I did come across credible information that started to allow everything to make sense, and I exited the rabbit hole. And it's a very pleasant and serene experience that we try to share it with people, but it's unreligion, because religion's very much about denying personal experience and going with things that are belief and not knowledge. And we're saying, let's innovate and get beyond that, because that doesn't seem very useful, and it seems to be used in every case to prey on people. And when you have organizations which exist by sacrificing children to protect itself, I can't say that that has anything to do with any creative influence or consciousness in this universe. Rather, it is the absence and insulation from it.
There's something to be said about self-responsibility. And, you know, once we decide to be open enough to consider all these different things, and really that's where we use our innate ability, then reason, compare and contrast all these different philosophies coming in, different beliefs coming in, all these different things, you know, to remain in that state of openness and be willing to question, you know, these authorities or these belief systems. That's taking a major step, a self towards your own responsibility, becoming human, realizing your own innate, potential. And I think that's it's an important step. They really schooled out of us. It's the proper term. And it's really just a continual, you know, this is a great fallacy, ad veracundium, a continual appeal to authority. And this would just be, and they say illegitimate authority. In this case, I'd say pretty much all authority or the belief in authority is illegitimate. So the belief itself is illegitimate and the fallacy of believing it in the first place. But, I mean, there are certain circumstances where that can be you know, consider differently. For example, if you're going to see a doctor that has some knowledge, but even still yet, for the most part, authority itself as a belief system, that is fallacious, and that's what holds us back and allows us to suspend our reasoning ability, our ability to ask questions, ability to try to find any sort of valid answers. We can just say, well, God said it, or, you know, what technology will save me, or any, or Jesus is coming, aliens are coming. You can name any number of crazy philosophies and just people expounding just really fantastical rhetoric.
That argument from authority right there, that's what God wants. It reminds me of what Rich said too about, you know, people are on a trip and they get to a rest stop and they think they're at their destination. Well, I mean, that explains organized religion retarding progress on this planet for 1,000 years, something that...
That's what religion means. Religare means to tie back, to bind back, to keep from growing.
Lig, like in ligaments.
Right.
Yeah. And I think this is really important, too, to point out why these fallacies are so dangerous, because like I said at the beginning of the last show, on the surface, they seem to be sound. If you're not looking, if you're not, like, really rigorous about this, and you already like, hey, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, and I just, you know, I'm starting with the default position of trust for these people, you're going to miss a lot of stuff, because people have this natural desire, obviously, to attain clarity, to remove contradictions. And when something is presented to them where on the surface it's like, yeah, good enough, there is so much deception that can be accomplished through that. So that's one of the reasons why I think it is so important to learn this stuff. And the argument, both of the, you know, Rich, your destination, your being the rest stop, and Tony, that's what God wants, really reminds me of that. And that's why I think this, or one reason why I think that this is so important. Guys, final thoughts.
Well, I guess my final thought would revolve around the idea of governments killing its own people, democide, and the use of the fallacy. I call it the Amtssprache fallacy, because when I first discovered it, it was in studying, you know, the Nuremberg trials, and it's, you know, they're asking, how did you get people to do this? And Amtssprache means official language, but what he meant was bureaucrat language. Through using bureaucrat language on typed up papers and you're getting orders from your superiors, it trained people into the fallacy, indoctrinated, you know, over generations of the Prussian education system. Finally, it culminates in the 1930s and 1940s with people saying, oh, I can void cause and effect magically because I have a boss, and my boss says, you're not responsible for your actions anymore, so therefore if we tell you to do something that you would think you would never do, it's okay because you're doing it for the state, you're doing it for Mother Russia, you're doing it for the fatherland of Germany, or whatever fallacy that you're under as far as, you know, these artificial control systems that they set up through the school systems, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is this fallacy that you can take actions but not be responsible for your own actions. So I call it the Amtssprache fallacy. But after reading Larkin Rose's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, he's saying, you know, it's this thing called authority that's the belief. And I was like, that's exactly what we're talking about. And so, like, again, it's finding these useful nomenclatures and these terms and these ideas brought together, and you're it's on the tip of your tongue, and then you read someone else's work and you're like, that's it. That's it. I don't have to. I'll just call it the fallacy of authority. It's exactly as he's describing it, right? It's not the fallacy of appealing to authority. There's that's a fallacy. And there are authorities in some cases like that, if you want to think of it and change the definition of authority, right? But after you learn the definition of it, and you learn that governments are only governments because they use force, fraud, and coercion, and if they didn't use force, fraud, and coercion, it would just be a bunch of individuals deciding to get things done, right?
Yeah.
And so it's this belief of, you know, these things that don't exist that then allow violence to be the solution to everything. And if we identify that as the problem and the root cause is irrationality, then we just have to decide not to be naive. That's what I did. I decided I wasn't going to be naive anymore, that good people sit around and do nothing, and that's the cause of evil. And doing nothing and not deciding, that's still a choice. So I can't negate cause and effect. I'm here, I'm living, I'm breathing, and now I have to take responsibility over my life, over my actions, over my words, and over my thoughts. And I have to do something constructive and meaningful with them, because that is my own self-defined purpose, because I'm the one here owning up to my life and having to support myself to get through it, just like everyone else. Mm. So the sooner that we can all recognize there's fallacies that are driving everything. When someone in a costume pulls you over, it's not that you should be disrespectful for them, but you should also recognize that this is a person who's trying to engage you in commerce, who has been indoctrinated to think that they can force you to do things, and because someone else wrote it down on a piece of paper.
to me, you have to treat them with some kindness and empathy and understanding. They are a human being who has been indoctrinated into believing irrational things like using force, fraud, and coercion and aggression and fear tactics are the way to get anything done, because they're, you know, that's just an example. And there are many people doing many jobs. You could talk about the teachers and how, you know, Gatto says you can't blame these teachers, because for whatever personal blame that they're not putting in, there's all this societal blame that's been passed down generation after generation in the form of the status quo culture that's been there and written and formed to contain us and control us and to school us, to conform us and adjust us into the similar beings that they can easily manage, because they don't know how to manage individuals. And so the sooner we learn how to become our individual selves, the sooner we're going to get real self-confidence that doesn't come in a box at the cost of some credit card, right? And that's what we need as Americans to resolve these situations and start handling things with self-reliance, is to first get our own self-esteem back. And how do you do that? You engage a method of viewing reality through your five senses. You neglect to concern yourself with these contradictions and these illusions. You stick to what's real. You get your priorities in line, and you don't do things that are in conflict with your survival.
Yeah. You know, you said a couple minutes ago that good people do nothing. I think it's really important to point out that another thing that good people do is bad things, you know, for the very reason that you described in Amsprache.
Right, right. And I think that even was driven home to me further when Larkin would say in his book that a lot of people come up to him and his wife and they say, wow, it's a shame that you guys were put in a cage, right? And he'd be like, you know, you're the same people voting for the people who put us in cages. And that made me really stop and think, because up until then, I kind of considered voting for Ron Paul, or, you know, not that I think my vote counts or that they count the votes or that the Electoral College is there to help us, but just because I felt like entertaining the illusion. And I read that sentence soon thereafter, and I was like, you know what? I can't do it. Like, I have to make a choice. I'm not going to go participate in something that's completely masturbatory, like voting. And I am going to continue to create media and to research and refine my perspectives, find my own blind spots, my own errors, and work on my own cogent communication comprehensively with others and creating tools. And you know, like the new show that we're doing, History So It Doesn't Repeat, it's history juxtaposed to current events so it doesn't continue to repeat. It only continues to repeat because we failed to learn from it. So we figured, let's create a vehicle that can enable everyone to learn under their own power, on their own time, of their own free volition, but it gives them their rights back. It gives them a chance to get their rights back, but you have to do a little work to actually take advantage of it.
You know, I have to say, I just want to quickly add that the importance of a method. We explained, or, you know, we talked about so many complex different concepts today on the show, but, you know, the irony here is the fact that if you don't have a method to try to discern what these concepts mean, how they apply in these different systems and these philosophical discourses, then it becomes very difficult. And that's what we try to do at Tragedy and Hope. You know, we're trying to come together, people out of their own volition are developing groups, study groups, either it's for Logic or for Tragedy and Hope, and reading group to go through the book, the first edition.
It's also named after a book, so that's confusing sometimes to people.
So, you know, we're just trying to develop, you know, as a community, much like a voluntary type of society would, and recognize needs and then trying to fulfill those needs where, you know, people are able to. And, you know,
It's a fear-free zone of mutual exploration where we share what we learn with each other and try to, you know, grow in the right direction. And I would say, if anything that we've said today during this episode of the School Sucks podcast has interested you, you can go to tragedyandhope.com, and at the top menu, there's a tab called Trivium. And if you just go through that tab in order, starting with How to Free Your Mind, I think you can get a lot more out of what you've discovered and kind of been, you just heard about it today, and it might be a little vague or confusing, but I promise if you invest a little of your hard-earned time, you will find results. And these aren't results that we have to promise, because we're not selling anything to you. I'm just saying, from my experience, I've used this method infinitely every day since I started to learn it. And the experience and exercise of my mind benefits me because I have a higher consistent rate of certainty. And that means I have less regret. And that equals more satisfaction. And I think that's what we're all looking for.
And I just want to thank you, Brett, for allowing me to participate today. One of the first podcasts I stumbled upon when I joined Tragedy and Hope was, in fact, your podcast, School Sucks. And I still today give that out regularly to friends and my parents as well, to try to wake them up, because I think it's one of the better formats to present some information about some of the system dynamics that are failing. So then I can, over time, present some of the philosophical underpinnings. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And, of course, I really appreciate the work that both of you guys do at Tragedy and Hope. And thank you so much for coming on the show. This was very helpful.
We look forward to another engagement in this variety.
Thank you very much, Brad.
Bernays soon became famous as the man who understood the mind of the crowd. And in 1924, the president contacted him. President Coolidge was a quiet, taciturn man and had become a national joke. The press portrayed him as a dull, humorless figure. Bernays' solution was to do exactly the same as he had done with products. He persuaded 34 famous film stars to visit the White House. And for the first time, politics became involved with public relations.
And I lined up these 34 people and I'd say, "What's your name?" He'd say, "Al Jolson." I'd say, "Mr. President, Al Jolson." Next stage, every newspaper in the United States had a front page story, President Coolidge entertains actors at White House. And the Times had a headline which said, "President nearly laughed." And everybody was happy.